Chapter 8.
The first thing you will learn today is how to shoot a gun. The second thing is how to win a fight.
Four presses a gun into my palm without looking at me and keeps walking.
Thankfully, if you are here, you already know how to get on and off a moving train, so I don't need to teach you that.
I shouldn't be surprised that the Dauntless expect us to hit the ground running, but I anticipated more than 6 hours of rest before the running began. My body is still heavy from sleep.
Initiation is divided into three stages. We will measure your progress and rank you according to your performance in each stage. The stages are not weighed equally in determining your final rank, so it is possible, though difficult, to drastically improve your rank over time.
I stare at the weapon in my hand. Never in my life did I expect to hold a gun, let alone fire one. It feels dangerous to me, as if just by touching it I could hurt someone.
We believe that preparation eradicates cowardice, which we define as the failure to act in the midst of fear, says Four. Therefore, each stage of initiation is intended to prepare you in a different way. The first stage is primarily physical, the second, primarily emotional, the third, primarily mental.
But what? Peter yawns through his words. What does firing a gun have to do with bravery?
Four flips the gun in his hand, presses the barrel to Peter's forehead, and clicks a bullet into place. Peter freezes with his lips parted, the yawn dead in his mouth.
Wake up, Four snaps. You were holding a loaded gun, you idiot. Act like it.
He lowers the gun. Once the immediate threat is gone, Peter's green eyes harden. I'm surprised he can stop himself from responding, after speaking his mind all his life in candor. But he does, his cheeks red.
And to answer your question, you are far less likely to soil your pants and cry for your mother if you're prepared to defend yourself.
Four stops walking at the end of the row and turns on his heel.
This is also information you may need later in stage one, so watch me.
He faces the wall with the targets on it, one square of plywood with three red circles on it for each of us. He stands with his feet apart, holds the gun in both hands and fires. The bang is so loud it hurts my ears. I crane my neck to look at the target. The bullet went through the middle circle. I turn to my own target. My family would never approve of me firing a gun.
They would say that guns are used for self-defense, if not violence, and therefore they are self-serving.
I push my family from my mind, set my feet shoulder-width apart, and delicately wrap both hands around the handle of the gun. It's heavy and hard to lift away from my body, but I want it to be as far from my face as possible. I squeeze the trigger, hesitantly at first and then harder, cringing away from the gun. The sound hurts my ears, and the recoil sends my hands back, toward my nose. I stumble, pressing my hand to the wall behind me for balance. I don't know where my bullet went, but I know it's not near the target. I fire again, and again, and again, and none of the bullets come close.
Statistically speaking, the erudite boy next to me, his name is Will, says, grinning at me, you should have hit the target at least once by now, even by accident. He is blonde, with shaggy hair, and a crease between his eyebrows.
Is that so? I say without inflection.
Yeah, he says.
I think you're actually defying nature.
I grip my teeth and turn toward the target, resolving to at least stand still. If I can't master the first task they give us, how will I ever make it through stage one? I squeeze the trigger, hard, and this time I'm ready for the recoil. It makes my hands jump back, but my feet stay planted. A bullet hole appears at the edge of the target, and I raise an eyebrow at Will.
So you see, I'm right. The stats don't lie, he says.
I smile a little. It takes me 5 rounds to hit the middle of the target, and when I do, a rush of energy goes through me. I am awake, my eyes wide open, my hands warm. I lower the gun. There is power in controlling something that can do so much damage, in controlling something, period. Maybe I do belong here. By the time we break for lunch, my arms throb from holding up the gun, and my fingers are hard to straighten. I massage them on my way to the dining hall.
Christina invites Al to sit with us. Every time I look at him, I hear his sobs again, so I try not to look at him. I move my peas around with my fork, and my thoughts drift back to the aptitude tests. When Tori warned me that being divergent was dangerous, I felt like it was branded on my face. And if I so much as turned the wrong way, someone would see it. So far, it hasn't been a problem, but that doesn't make me feel safe. What if I let my guard down and something terrible happens?
Oh, come on. You don't remember me?
Christina asks Al as she makes a sandwich.
We were in math together just a few days ago. I'm not a quiet person.
I slept through math most of the time, Al replies.
It was first hour.
What if the danger doesn't come soon? What if it strikes years from now, and I never see it coming?
Triss, says Christina. She snaps her fingers in front of my face. You in there?
What? What is it?
I asked if you remember ever taking a class with me, she says. I mean, no offense, but I probably wouldn't remember if you did. All the abnegations look the same to me. I mean, they still do. But now you're not one of them.
I stare at her, as if I need her to remind me.
Sorry, am I being rude? She asks. I'm used to just saying whatever is on my mind. Mom used to say that politeness is deception in pretty packaging.
I think that's why our factions don't usually associate with each other, I say with a short laugh. Candor and abnegation don't hate each other the way erudite and abnegation do, but they avoid each other. Candor's real problem is with amity. Those who seek peace above all else, they say, will always deceive to keep the water calm.
Can I sit here? Says Will, tapping the table with his finger.
What, you don't want to hang out with your erudite buddies? Says Christina.
They aren't my buddies, says Will, setting his plate down. Just because we were in the same faction doesn't mean we get along. Plus, Edward and Myra are dating, and I would rather not be the third wheel.
Edward and Myra, the other erudite transfers, sit two tables away, so close they bump elbows as they cut their food. Myra pauses to kiss Edward. I watch them carefully. I've only seen a few kisses in my life.
Edward turns his head and presses his lips to Myra's. Air hisses between my teeth, and I look away. Part of me waits for them to be scolded. Another part wonders, with a touch of desperation, what it would feel like to have someone's lips against mine.
Do they have to be so public? I say.
She just kissed him.
Al frowns at me. When he frowns, his thick eyebrows touch his eyelashes. It's not like they're stripping naked.
A kiss is not something you do in public.
Al, Will, and Christina all give me the same knowing smile.
What?
I say.
Your abnegation is showing, says Christina. The rest of us are all right with a little affection in public.
Oh, I shrug. Well, I guess I'll have to get over it then.
Or you can stay frigid, says Will, his green eyes glinting with mischief. You know, if you want.
Christina throws a roll at him. He catches it and bites it.
Don't be mean to her, she says. Frigidity is in her nature. Sort of like being a know-it-all is in yours.
I am not frigid, I exclaim. Don't worry about it, says Will. It's endearing.
Look, you're all red.
The comment only makes my face hotter. Everyone else chuckles. I force a laugh, and after a few seconds, it comes naturally.
It feels good to laugh again.